This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is World AIDS Day, a day for discussion, planning for the future, and remembering those whose lives were taken by the disease. My guest, Dr. Jonathan Mann, was one of the organizers of the first World AIDS Day in 1988. Dr. Mann is an epidemiologist. From 1986 to 1990, he was the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global Program on AIDS. He's also senior editor of the book AIDS in the World. He's been a professor at Harvard School of Public Health for 7 years. We asked Dr. Mann to talk with us about the current state of the AIDS epidemic and the latest developments in treating it. Let's start with the latest statistics on the epidemic spread released by the UN in its World AIDS Day report.
Well, the UN AIDS program, which is the joint and co-sponsored program that brings together six United Nations agencies together, has developed its latest figures, which basically show that the global epidemic in 1997 grew by about 14%. There were about 5.8 million new HIV infections around the world, which translates to about 16,000 people a day who became newly infected with HIV during 1997. There, in addition, were an estimated 2.3 million deaths in 1997. So the global epidemic is expanding, it's intensifying, and actually one of the figures that I found most dramatic is that there are an estimated 30.6 million people living with HIV and AIDS in the world today. And that translates to 1 per 100 sexually active people 15 to 49 years old in the world. In other words, 1 out of every 100 sexually active 15 to 49-year-olds in the world is infected today and is living with HIV.
You say that the number of people with AIDS grew by 14% in 1997. How does that compare to last year? What was the rate of growth?
Well, the epidemic has been continuing to grow. The 14% is the total number of HIV-infected people in the world. It's growing at different rates in different places. For example, in the United States, there's actually, for the first time in 1996 and again in 97, some very good news, which is that in 1996, for the first time, the number of new AIDS cases declined compared to 1995, in other words, compared to the year before, by 6%, and the number of AIDS deaths in 1996 went down about 25% compared to 1995. So in some parts of the world, the United States being one, there has actually been a downturn in the number of new AIDS cases and particularly deaths. In other parts of the world, like sub-Saharan Africa, which is the most heavily affected part of the world, or in Southeast Asia, the epidemic is continuing to expand at a very rapid pace. So it's a very mixed picture throughout the world.
Any other ways you interpret these new statistics?
Well, I think that the most important thing is that about 99% of the new infections with HIV are occurring in the developing world. And when we talk, as I hope we will, about the impact of treatment, which is really the reason why AIDS cases and AIDS deaths have declined in the United States, when we talk about treatment and treatment availability, that fact of the vast majority of new infections occurring in the developing world, I think we'll have to keep that strongly in mind.
Are the patterns of how HIV is spreading different in the have and the have-not countries?
There are very many differences between the, as you say, the have and the have-not countries, between the industrialized world and the developing world. The basic modes of spread, of course, are always fundamentally the same. Sexual contact, contact with blood. So in some industrialized countries, for example, like the United States, injecting drug use plays a very important role, as does sex between men who have sex with men. In other parts of the world, like sub-Saharan Africa, the epidemic, which is quite large, is being driven principally by heterosexual transmission. Another way of expressing that is that in sub-Saharan Africa, 50% of the infected people are women, whereas in North America, in Latin America, only about 20% of the infected people are women. So there are differences in the dominant route of spread, but the fundamental roots are the same.
What's your favorite hypothesis about why the percentage of people with AIDS who are women is so much higher in other countries than it is in the United States?
Well, I think it still comes back to the question of the dominant route of spread at a point in time. When AIDS first appeared in the United States, men who have sex with men accounted for the very large majority of all AIDS cases. The proportion of people acquiring AIDS heterosexually, which then, of course, will mean the proportion of women infected as well, has gradually been increasing. So there's been a steady upward turn. And in fact, despite those very, very impressive and positive statistics that I quoted for the United States in 1996 compared to 95, in that same period, the number of new AIDS cases among African-American heterosexual men and heterosexual women increased between 12 and 19%. So everywhere, what we see is that the route of spread will determine who will be infected. Those routes can evolve as they have in the United States. So you could say in sum that the U.S. started as an epidemic that looks pretty much like an epidemic among gay men, and then evolved gradually into an epidemic that increasingly affects injecting drug users and heterosexual transmission. And by the way, I should mention that wherever you see heterosexual transmission, as in sub-Saharan Africa, you're going to see a lot of infected children. So in 1997, of the 5.8 million new HIV infections, there were about 600,000 children, or 1,600 children a day, becoming infected with HIV, mostly from spread of infection from the mother, infected mother, to the fetus or the newborn child.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jonathan Mann. Today is World AIDS Day. He's the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global AIDS Program and a professor of public health at Harvard University. Are we seeing any new emergent strains of the HIV virus?
I don't think we're seeing particularly new emergent strains, but we're learning more about what exists. And there, we've been able to see that there are different subtypes of the AIDS virus in different parts of the world. So in, for example, Thailand, the subtype that dominates among people who've acquired the infection sexually differs from the subtype among those who have acquired the infection through injecting drug use. Those may differ from the subtype in Latin America or in Africa or in North America. But I think that we can say that, you know, the virus doesn't show any clear signs of evolving in a large sense. But that, in a sense, that statement could, in a sense, conceal what happens at the more individual level. The new drugs that have become available, the so-called combination therapy that has produced such remarkable changes in the fate of HIV-infected people in the United States, basically reducing the rate of developing AIDS in among people who are HIV-infected, and for people who have AIDS, protecting them, and in many cases, leading to a dramatic clinical reversal. People who look very weak and very thin and are clearly extremely ill, who regain weight, regain a sense of well-being, and return to essentially a normal life. It's a truly remarkable occurrence that these drugs are now available. Now, when drugs like this become available, and particularly when they're widely used, and particularly because these drugs are so complicated in terms of their how many you take and when you take them, and whether you take them with food or between meals and so forth, as well as the use of these drugs occasionally for what could be called post-exposure prophylaxis. Someone has what they think might be a high-risk sexual contact. They then take some of these drugs for a short period of time. These are circumstances in which we can expect and anticipate resistance to the drugs to emerge. So at the individual level, there can be escape. There can be strains of the virus that evolve in response to the presence of the antiviral agents and that become resistant to the drugs that we have. This has not yet become a public health problem, but it is one we can anticipate.
Do we have any new insights into what happens to the virus when a person with HIV is taking these new combination therapies?
What we found is that in people whose plasma virus level drops to an undetectable level, which is a very small level, in other words, with modern techniques, we can detect a very small number of viruses in the blood. People with undetectable levels of virus, because they are taking this combination therapy, nevertheless, in some cells in their body, are harboring virus. In other words, it's hard to get to that virus. It's been difficult to detect it, but now it's been shown to exist. And so we can't really talk about cure at this point. we can only talk at this point about very, very remarkable suppression of the virus. Hopefully, over the long term, after years of suppression, it might be possible that eradication of the virus from an individual could occur. But that will be a race in time between the development of resistant strains and the duration of effect of the drug. We just don't have all the answers yet, but we really can't speak in a strict sense of cure.
So now it's as if viruses are hiding out in cells when somebody takes the combination therapy. And if they stop taking those drugs, then the cells would come out of hiding and start reproducing again?
This is what is currently thought. As you can understand, because these drugs and their use is relatively recent, we don't have all the answers yet. But I think what we can liken it to is when new drugs are developed against bacteria, for example, there's an immediate positive effect. People can indeed, and sometimes in the case of bacteria, be cured. People are very optimistic. And then there's another phase that follows, which is a phase where we realize some of the limitations of the drug, some of the problems, what will some of the side effects be with long-term use of the drug. There's a lot to be learned, but there's still a very good piece of news in all of this. We just wish that this was good news that could be applicable at a global level, which is really in some ways why there is so much more attention now being given to vaccine.
Vaccine. Let's get to the vaccine. Where are we?
Well, we're in a paradoxical place. This is a little hard to understand why we have not had more progress towards vaccine development. I say that because there have been over 30 phase 1 trials, that is, trials of candidate vaccines to determine that they are safe. There have only been 3 phase 2 trials, and there is no trial yet underway which would demonstrate whether or not a vaccine candidate is effective. I think the reason we haven't progressed further in all the time that's been and energy and money that's been spent towards vaccine, in a sense, is that the vaccine development situation has been taken over by a pure scientific model. By that I mean that the basic scientists, the research scientists who've done wonderful things, are asking for all the answers to try to understand every little bit of how a vaccine candidate might work before they will give the green light to testing a vaccine in people. However, the history of vaccine development, from smallpox to measles to the new Lyme disease vaccine that will be coming out soon, all demonstrate that at a certain point in time, even though scientists may disagree, it's important to take something that is safe, to try it in people, to learn from that, and then return to the basic science and back and forth until the best vaccine is available. The people must remember that we still today don't understand how smallpox vaccine works in detail. If we waited for all that information, we'd still have smallpox instead of living in a world in which smallpox has been eradicated.
A few people have offered to basically be human guinea pigs for the testing of an AIDS vaccine. And this has, of course, sparked a big ethical debate about whether that's appropriate or not. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the vaccine that they are offering themselves to, they're offering to be tested with, is a live attenuated vaccine, which is so far at this point from being a vaccine that we could imagine being safe and available and ultimately made available, that I think their gesture, the courage of which I admire, because there's a long tradition of physicians putting themselves on the line for what they believe might work in terms of therapy and prevention. So I admire the gesture. I just wish that they chose a more appropriate product. That is to say that I wish that they were pushing for the trials of vaccines that we already have information about in terms of safety. To be injected with an attenuated or a weakened strain of HIV raises very, very serious long-term questions of what would happen to that attenuated virus in a person. So I welcome the gesture, I admire the gesture, but I really think that it distracts, unfortunately, from the principal problem we have, which is that we have candidate vaccines ready to test, and yet we've not been able to move that next step forward. It is a failure of public health leadership, which is costing us not only in financial terms, but obviously in human terms around the world, because only an AIDS vaccine will be able to bring this epidemic under control.
My guest is epidemiologist Dr. Jonathan Mann. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today is World AIDS Day, and my guest is Dr. Jonathan Mann. He was the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global AIDS Program. He's a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. One of the concerns that you've been worried about for years is that in poor countries, people can't afford whatever treatments are available for AIDS. There's another controversy now about what's happening in poor countries, and this pertains to the testing of drugs there. Would you explain the controversy to us?
Yeah. When it was found that AZT could dramatically reduce the rate of spread of HIV from an infected pregnant woman to her newborn, the question arose whether a short course of the same drug would work in the developing world, because a short course would be much more affordable. The controversy arose when the short course of drug was compared with a placebo, that is, was compared with giving nothing, when in fact there is a preventive strategy available, which is the full course AZT as used in the industrialized world. This raised a number of very, very important issues about the relationship between industrialized and developing country researchers, their goals, the ethical questions involved, and so forth.
So for instance, are we the wealthier country using the people in the poorer country as our guinea pigs?
Well, it wasn't so much in this case that we were using people as guinea pigs as that we were depriving them of a known effective treatment, even though that known effective treatment was in no way available and would not be available in that developing country. So it becomes a question of standard of care. When you are doing a trial in a developing country, should you use the local standard of care, which would have been no treatment at all, or do you use the best available global standard of care, which would be the treatment as used in the United States? So the implication was that perhaps researchers were behaving unethically and depriving women of a known effective treatment. And I think that the fundamental question really does get to the point of for whose benefit is the research being done, and also to take a public health perspective of the importance of learning this kind of information as rapidly as possible, because with 1,600 infants being infected each day, principally in the developing world, we need a simple, effective, usable way to prevent those children from being infected.
I understand you were recently at an AIDS conference in Geneva in which you heard a lot of people who are from developing countries and who don't have access to the new drugs, can't afford the new drugs. What did they have to say?
Actually, I think this is a terribly difficult problem for us all, because when we first confronted AIDS in the early and mid-1980s, we really were all in this same boat together. North, south, east, and west, we didn't have any drugs, we didn't have any treatment, we didn't have a vaccine, obviously. What we had was common sense, what we had was good public health, what we had was exchange of information, of ideas about how to prevent infection. And then in the midst of this equality, this solidarity in front of the disease, drugs became available only to the rich. And then the poor see the rich getting the drugs and living, while they who are infected do not get the drugs and die. It is literally as stark as that. Now, what this does is bring forward once again the fundamental inequity that has existed always and continues to exist in many other areas. It exists in areas where preventable and treatable diseases go unprevented and untreated in the developing world simply for that fact of not having the money to buy the drug or pay for the drug. The fact, however, that in AIDS this has emerged in front of our very eyes, that it isn't an inherited inequity, it's an inequity that we've actually seen develop right in front of us, it's so difficult to be for industrialized country people to be excited as they deserve to be about the new drugs, and then to see the faces of those who will never get those drugs, who will not have those drugs, and who will die as a result. My hope here is that tension, that ethical dilemma, will push people not to deny it or look away from the problem, but to say to themselves, what can we do for the developing world? And I sincerely believe and feel that the answer to that lies in vaccine. lies in the need to emphasize, to put the energy and the resources not into basic research on vaccine, but now into moving vaccines into the development phase so that they can become a reality. This, I think, will be the expression of global solidarity from an industrialized world that has drugs that treat to a world which needs desperately to prevent the over 95% of infections that are occurring in the developing world.
Dr. Jonathan Mann is a professor at Harvard School of Public Health. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with epidemiologist Dr. Jonathan Mann. Today is World AIDS Day. He was an organizer of the first World AIDS Day in 1988. From 1986 to 1990, he was the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global Program on AIDS. Dr. Mann is a professor at Harvard School of Public Health. There's an interesting article in November in the New York Times basically asking the question, is it time to challenge the idea that AIDS is a special illness, that people with AIDS are entitled to kind of special benefits, whether it's free hot lunches, free haircuts, art classes, legal advice, dinners delivered. And these are all the special services that arose through a kind of informal AIDS network of people who were concerned about friends and loved ones and neighbors who had an illness, and the illness was such a frightening illness to people. A lot of people treated people with AIDS as if they were lepers. Now we know more about AIDS and so on, but this incredible network with these special support services has developed in the interim. So have you been following this debate?
Yeah, I have, and actually, I think many of us for quite a long time have felt that AIDS is not special, but that we shouldn't respond to that idea by lowering standards of AIDS care back to the way it is for others, but rather use AIDS as an example of how what people need can actually be provided and how important that can be. I remember back in the late 1980s visiting San Francisco General Hospital, visiting the AIDS ward there, and being very impressed by all the amenities, the comfortable chairs, the plants, the VCR, the television, and so forth. And then going to the cancer ward fairly nearby, and the cancer ward was sort of a regular cancer ward, like you'd imagine. I think the response to that, again, is not to make the AIDS ward like the cancer ward, but make the cancer ward like the AIDS ward. And so I think that we really have learned a lot about the importance, for example, of dignity in the context of this epidemic. We've learned how critical it is that people who have a disease, no matter what disease or condition, be accorded dignity. And people with AIDS have fought for and demanded that dignity. Well, that same issue of dignity applies as much to people with cancer or heart disease or other conditions. So I think that it's a very healthy debate, and I think that the period of time when we saw AIDS as a completely unique phenomenon really ended some time ago. We now recognize that in this country, for example, if we really want to deal seriously with AIDS, we're not only going to have to deal seriously with issues of health care for all Americans, but we're going to have to deal with the factors in our society that make people vulnerable to HIV in the first place. And that includes racism as just one piece of that picture. Similarly, around the world, we're seeing that the underlying root causes of vulnerability to AIDS are the same conditions which create vulnerability to the other major causes of premature disability, illness, and death in the world. So I think we're at the verge of a reintegration, in a sense, of work against AIDS with broader work to improve health in this country and abroad.
What else are you thinking about on this World AIDS Day?
Well, I am first of all thinking of the first World AIDS Day in 1988, and how on that day, how exciting it was that in every single country in the world, there was activity among non-governmental organizations, among private people, around the issue of AIDS. The slogan for the first World AIDS Day was, "Tell the world what you're doing about AIDS." And I'll always remember the feeling in WHO headquarters as, in a sense, the countries around the world lit up one after another as we received reports of activities that people were using that day, that World AIDS Day, to really say something about the importance of AIDS and what they were doing and what needed to be done. Since then, World AIDS Day has remained a day that belongs to people, not to governments. It's not an official day that vanishes, you know, in the long list of official days. And even though there are official declarations and proclamations, the real heart of World AIDS Day has always been what people do on that day to think about AIDS, to remember those who have died, to think about how important it is to protect the living.
What is the theme of this World AIDS Day?
The theme of this World AIDS Day is children living in a world with AIDS. And I think that formulation is important because it concerns not only the 600,000 children newly infected in 1997. It doesn't only include the 1.1 million children who are living with HIV or AIDS this year. It also includes the rest of the world's children. We grew up, that is, those of us who are in our 40s and 50s, grew up in a world in which we grew up in a world without AIDS. Today's children grow up in a world that has this entirely new fact that is so important to their lives and to their behavior. I think it's really a very good thing that the UN AIDS program is focusing this year's attention as the major theme of World AIDS Day on the question of the children, children who are vulnerable to infection, children who are infected, and children who need to know and understand because this is now a world in which AIDS is a fact.
Well, Dr. Jonathan Mann, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Jonathan Mann is a professor at Harvard School of Public Health. In January, he will become dean of the New School of Public Health at Allegheny University of Health Sciences in Philadelphia.